Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Philbrook Museum's exhibit, Whistler and the British Etching Revival, closes next week. The exhibit documents the renewed interest in etching during the 19th century, which featured works created by the artist's own hand rather than an interpretation by a printmaker, as was common in the day. James McNeill Whistler, the American expatriate artist, was a leader in this movement. A selection of his prints, as well as others in his circle, is currently on display at the museum through April 5th. My guest today will be lecturing next week during the exhibit's final days. Martha Tedeschi is a deputy director for art and research at the Art Institute of Chicago. She specializes in prints and drawings and Whistler's work in particular. She was editor and co-author of Whistler's lithographic catalog Raisonné and has organized numerous exhibits for the Art Institute. She'll be speaking next Thursday, a week from today, April 2nd, at the museum at 6 o'clock. She joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Martha Tedeschi, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We look forward to your appearance at Philbrook, talking about Whistler and his etchings. And one of the things this show that's been up at Philbrook in the paper gallery is looked at is when so many artists were turning to lithographs and engraving types of printmaking because they could make multiple editions of a painting, Whistler is going back to this old tradition of etching. What attracted him to that?
Well, you're right to talk about reproductions of paintings because that's where the story starts. Printmaking by the middle of the 19th century, and we're talking about Britain, but also America and Europe. But since the show is focused on Britain, we'll kind of concentrate on that in our story because that's also where Whistler was living most of his life. So by the middle of the 19th century, it was most common for famous paintings to be reproduced for the public in the form of engravings or, as you say, sometimes chromolithographs, color lithographs, because engravings and lithographs could be published in very large editions and they could give a good semblance of a popular painting and be sold to, you know, hundreds and even thousands of people. So there became a very lucrative print market for the sale of reproductive prints, in other words, prints that reproduce the famous paintings of the day. But what tended to happen was, you know, that there would be a kind of interpretation made by the engraver or the lithographer. In other words, it was not the artist making the prints, the painter of the original painting. It was another engraver who would do a translation. And as people began to understand that there was a qualitative difference between having the artist's own hand and the engraver being a translator, they became more interested in having examples from the artist's own hand that could take the form of original drawings. But, of course, original drawings are fewer, rarer, because they're not produced in multiple, and they were more expensive. So many painters, and Whistler was one of the leaders of this, what we call the etching revival, decided to make their own prints, and they chose etching largely, although Whistler did make his own lithographs as well. But they largely chose etching because it's relatively easy to do, and one can draw very freely on the etching plate, which is usually a copper plate. And etching is made when you cover a copper plate with varnish, and then the artist uses a needle to draw through the varnish, removing the varnish, but using a very fluid line, very much like drawing with a pencil on paper. The areas that are exposed by the needle then become eaten away when the plate is submerged in acid. So the acid eats away the lines, but the artist isn't really having to exert any pressure. The acid does that. So because artists could work very freely in etching, it became really almost the same thing as having an original drawing by the artist, because every line that you're looking at was made by the great artist, the painter himself or herself. So that's really how the etching revival takes off, is when artists begin to respond to a desire on the part of collectors, especially more knowledgeable collectors, for something that really is close to the artist rather than removed by a translator.
Now, what's our thinking about Whistler? Was he doing it for the commercial concern, or was it more, I want to control my output that has my name on it when you give it to a printer to make a print, obviously it's out of his hands. Was it that concern, or was it strictly commercial?
It was both, very much both. I think first and foremost, it was his desire to be his own translator, to not be interpreted by, you know, a lesser artisan who might, you know, not really understand his emphases or what he was trying to achieve. Whistler's art was very ethereal, very distilled, quite abstract. And, you know, the medium of engraving, which is so laborious, was really not well-suited to translating his images. So he was looking for a medium that would allow him to have the same aesthetic values in his prints that he could in his drawings, his watercolors, pastels, oils. And this is a very light-touch kind of aesthetic. With etching, he not only could, you know, use these very delicate silvery lines that he would draw on the copper plate, but in the printing of it, he could manipulate the ink in a way that he was almost painting on the plate. So he could create, with the same image, a print that looked nocturnal, and then one that looked, you know, like a rainy day, and one that looked like bright sun, simply by the way he manipulated the ink in the printing process. So I think he found etching very sympathetic to his own aesthetic ambitions. But, as you point out, there was the commercial side of things, and he turned out to be a master marketer. He developed all kinds of strategies for making his etchings more valuable, more sought after by collectors, particularly more sophisticated collectors.
And what were some of the things he would do?
Well, he began to, if you look at any number of Whistler etchings, you will begin to see that many of them are cut right to the plate mark, so they don't have margins. But he leaves a little tiny tab at the bottom sticking out, sort of the size of a thumbnail, and signs his butterfly signature on this little tab. Well, this was a very distinctive way of presenting an etching. It was not common to trim them that way. But those with the tab and the butterfly signature immediately became the more rarefied impressions. And would sell for more. The other thing he did is he would change his plates slightly over time, creating new states. So he'd print up a plate, you know, and maybe make 10 impressions, and then he'd do some more work on the plate and then print another 10 impressions. And so, you know, it became a kind of stamp collecting game for collectors to say, well, you know, I have a first state, I have a signed second state. You know, I have all three states. So he created a kind of, you know, collector's hierarchy.
So he was playing this art game then.
he was definitely creating a kind of market and a particular, very unique connoisseurship just for his prints.
Now, the other thing is really interesting, if you look at many of his etchings and compare them to what he does painting-wise. Now, we think of his domestic scenes and nocturnes in his oil paintings, but in his etchings, there's a very different side that we see to him, because there's almost a documentary sense to many of his etchings.
Yeah.
He's down on the docks, street scenes, working men. Certainly, he always loved to paint nautical scenes, and he etched nautical scenes as well, but it seems like instead of reflecting his painted output, he differed greatly from his painting subject matter.
You know, I think that's really true in the way he started out with etching. But, you know, as he did in his painting, his style changed pretty dramatically in the course of his career. So he starts out as pretty much of a realist or a naturalist, and that's when he paints, you know, some of those early domestic scenes of his family, and he does some etchings of the same subjects. And then there is this documentary impulse that you're talking about, which would be particularly true of one of his early etching sets called the Thames set, where
yes.
He went sort of slumming around the docks and created, you know, really evocative prints like Black Lion's Wharf or Rotherhithe, where you see the working men and the sort of ramshackle houses along the docks. And, you know, they're very much realist prints. And people liked them. The Thames set was actually very successful and helped to establish his reputation as a printmaker. But as time went on, he moves in his painting more towards aestheticism. So moving away from such a realist approach, and, you know, the nocturnes are maybe the prime example where they become more about memory and atmosphere and, you know, become considerably more abstract and evocative rather than documentary. And this occurs, this shift occurs in his prints, too. So when he goes to Venice in 1880, he begins to do these images of old Palazzi in Venice with the canals, you know, the sort of moisture coming up from the canals and the light flickering on the water and on the facades of buildings. And he becomes very minimal, so that he's doing relatively little work on the plate. And instead, when he prints these prints, he uses a great deal of plate tone, surface tone, and manipulates it to create nocturnes that, you know, they don't look exactly like his painted nocturnes, but they have that same approach, which is more evocative, certainly more distilled and minimal, and more about atmosphere. So one senses a time of day and even a temperature rather than, you know, a great deal of detail about the locale.
Yeah, and some of those Venice prints, it's almost as if, you know, your mind is filling in a lot of the scene.
Yeah, that was part of it.
It would be a squiggle on the line, and from the way the squiggles are arranged, you sort of see this image that's really not there on the paper.
Right, and some, you know, some people didn't like that, and there was a famous court case in which he sued the art critic John Ruskin.
That's right.
Who had slandered him, according to Whistler, for implying that he was selling unfinished paintings. Because Whistler, in fact, was becoming more and more minimal, more suggestive, expecting, you know, the viewer to bring feeling and emotion to the work, to kind of fill it out. And he felt that, you know, it was really the artist's job to look at nature and then distill what was most beautiful about nature, not just to replicate it. And, you know, that was not necessarily the typical Victorian painting sensibility, where people wanted to see that an artist had been laboring over something and making it extremely detailed. And so Whistler was a rebel in that regard, and not everybody got it. But increasingly, that style of, you know, suggestivity became what was prized by, let's say, more sophisticated connoisseurs or collectors, more progressive collectors. And, you know, those were certainly Whistler's patrons.
My guest today is Martha Tedeschi, the Deputy Director for Art and Research at the Art Institute of Chicago. She specializes in Whistler. One of her main works is a look at his lithograph, and we may talk about that as well. Philbrook Museum is featuring Whistler and the British Etching Revival, which closes next week, and she'll also be speaking next week at Philbrook as a part of that last week of the exhibit. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Whistler, was he sort of the first one to jump on the etching bandwagon, of getting this artist's own hand involved in printmaking, or were there other artists that influenced him, or did he influence other artists?
There were other artists that influenced him, and I'll point to two. One was his brother-in-law, Seymour Haydon, who was an amateur etcher. He actually was a doctor, a surgeon. But he took up an early interest in etching because he was a collector of Rembrandt's prints. Rembrandt, who also was a great etcher of the 17th century. And Seymour Haydon, Whistler's brother-in-law, formed a very sizable collection of Rembrandt's prints, which I think eventually ended up at the British Museum. So they're there today. But Seymour Haydon acquired an etching press and began to make his own etchings inspired by Rembrandt. And his young brother-in-law, James McNeil Whistler, began to take an interest both in the Rembrandts and in the etching press. And so, in a way, his first mentor in etching was Seymour Haydon. He had been introduced to the medium as a student in Paris, where there were artists beginning to use the medium, and perhaps the most visible one at the time that Whistler had been in Paris as a student was Charles Marion. And Whistler took a great deal from Marion and Marion's printer, who I think really was another kind of mentor in the printmaking process to Whistler. And Marion, like Whistler would eventually do, made many states of his prints and would change the plates quite dramatically from one version to another. And he also experimented with printing them in different colors of ink and on different colors of paper so that he could get different atmospheric effects. And this was very influential to what Whistler would eventually develop in his own practice. So I think, you know, first as a student in Paris and then in London with his brother-in-law, Seymour Haydon, that is sort of where the seeds, where we see the seeds of the etching revival starting.
Mm. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you're sort of a specialist on his lithographs. How do his lithographs differ from his etchings?
Well, the medium is very different.
Yes.
So we talked about etching and the way one can draw quite freely on a copper plate. In a lithograph, one uses a greasy black crayon on the surface of a very smooth piece of limestone. And that, in some ways, is even a freer feeling for the artist than an etching is, because one isn't even having to scratch off the varnish. One simply draws on this smooth limestone, which has the consistency almost of a piece of paper. It's so smooth. So lithographs actually feel for the artist very much like doing a drawing. And then with the help of a professional printer, they get worked up, and there's a sort of chemical bath that's put over the surface to etch the image into the stone. And usually the artist needs some professional support for the printing process at that point. But the drawing part itself is as close to making an original drawing as one can imagine. And Whistler took advantage of that to do some of his most delicate, most ethereal, most distilled subjects in lithography. He actually called them songs on stone, trying to indicate that they were the lightest, the most fleeting, the most ethereal of all of his images. And so he worked in a very dedicated way in lithography. He did really pioneer the use of transfer paper, which allowed him, instead of lugging a heavy stone around with him, he could take these little sketchbooks of transfer paper and make drawings as he was walking around the city. So he would, you know, go into little picturesque neighborhoods and make pictures of antique churches and you know, little courtyards that he found on his wandering.
It's kind of a version of plein air printing.
Yes, it is. And he could do these on transfer paper and then bring them back to his printer, who would then transfer them to the surface of the stone. So he did some work on stone, and this his long-suffering printer, Thomas Way, actually lugged these stones around for him, notoriously even in a boat, so he could make his famous lithographs of Battersea Bridge. But eventually he realized that it was going to be easier and freer for him to work with these little blocks of transfer paper. So he made about 179 lithographs, which is much less than the number of etchings in his output. He made about 450 etchings. Nevertheless, he took the medium very seriously and does something quite different in lithography than etching.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like when you talk about Whistler's printmaking, it's the etchings that get all the attention. Are the lithographs overlooked?
Yeah, and that's partly why we did our project here at the Art Institute. We actually did a definitive catalog raisonné because mm-hmm. there hadn't been one since Whistler's lifetime. And then we also did an exhibition in which we placed the lithographs in context so that, you know, Whistler was someone who really believed in iteration, and you can see him depicting the same models in the same poses, for example, in the studio, in a variety of media, from etching to lithography to pastel to oil and watercolor. And it's very instructive to see how he moved from one medium to another and how he tweaked his approach for each medium. So he was really trying to exploit each medium in which he worked for its best characteristics. And so we took the approach of taking the lesser-known prints, the lithographs, and putting them in context so that, you know, one could begin to understand the unique role that they played for Whistler.
Now, a lot of artists use lithography as a way of, to take their paintings and make multiple editions. Did Whistler do that, or was he doing specialized images of whether it's his etching material or his lithographs, to sort of create individual images as opposed to reproducing something that he's already painted?
Yeah, well, as usual with Whistler, the answer seems to be all of the above. He certainly did do some additions, and he had planned some other additions that never took off. He also created a number of images for reproduction in journals, illustrated journals, so that they would have had a really wide circulation. This is true of his two famous images of Battersea Bridge, for example, were created for, you know, a fairly popular art journal. So those are the sort of widest distribution examples. But then there are many of his lithographs, or, you know, at least a significant number that were printed in only one or two impressions, and even some that are unique. And those tend to be ones that were truly experiments. And, you know, if he didn't like them, he didn't multiply them. But in some cases, he allowed himself to be very experimental. And then in some cases, the transfer paper just didn't transfer properly to the stone, and the effect wasn't what he wanted. And so those he usually would put aside after only one or two impressions. So it really runs the gamut. But he certainly did hope at one point when he first adopted lithography that it would really help make him rich.
Did that ever happen?
No, not really. He was a litigious sort and always seemed to have a lot of bills. So I don't think we can ever say that he was rich.
My guest today is Martha Tedeschi, Deputy Director of Art and Research at the Art Institute of Chicago. She'll be a guest of Philbrook next week for the last week of their Works on Paper show, Whistler and the British Etching Revival. What are you going to be speaking about when you're here?
Well, I'm going to be speaking about Whistler, but not exclusively. I'm going to be talking about, the title of my talk is The Writing of Modern Life, and I'm going to be talking about how etching did allow artists a kind of freedom to record modern life in a way that was more nimble, more flexible, more of the moment and spontaneous, you know, maybe the equivalent of writing a poem, whereas, you know, painting a major oil painting would be the equivalent of writing a novel. So, you know, talking about the kind of nimbleness and spontaneity that appealed to artists of this moment who were so interested in capturing the flavor of modern life.
Now we usually think of plein air painting as what the best way to do that. Was technology changing so that printmaking could be not a laborious process in a studio, but something more ethereal and easy to do?
Well, I don't think the medium of etching had actually changed much since Rembrandt's time, for example, but it always was a pretty spontaneous medium. And if you look at some of Rembrandt's prints all the way back in the 17th century, he uses little tiny plates sometimes to do very intimate, sketchy little self-portraits or portraits of a child or an artisan, and they are very much little pictures from modern life, little sketches. Almost the equivalent to working in a sketchbook, which is so different from the kind of pressure that's on an artist to create a major oil painting that would eventually be submitted to public exhibitions and so on. So etchings, you know, there was a kind of privacy about being able to make them wherever you were, and a kind of spontaneity. And then, of course, they did have a market and they became very popular, but there was never the kind of pressure, I think, you know, that the painters experienced in creating canvases that were, you know, going to be judged publicly.
Well, we look forward to your visit and hope a lot of people come out to Philbrook in the last week to see these Whistler and also his brother-in-law, Hayden.
Seymour Hayden. Yeah,
Seymour. There's some work by both of those artists on display at Philbrook. Martha Tedeschi, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Martha Tedeschi is the Deputy Director for Art and Research at the Art Institute of Chicago. She specializes in the work of James McNeill Whistler. Whistler's work, his etchings, are on display in a small exhibit at Philbrook Museum titled Whistler and the British Etching Revival, which closes next week. Tedeschi will be speaking Thursday, April 2nd at the museum at 6 o'clock. Information at philbrook.org. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
I'm speaking very quietly because I don't want them to hear me. They're already out to get me, and I don't want them to know I'm on to them. I've come up with my own version of string theory. I've accepted that all living things are connected in some great way. I talk to my plants, I praise the singing birds and insects, but doesn't everybody do that? Now I know that the inanimate objects around me have life too. The machines and equipment and gadgets, they all belong to a community, humming and buzzing about me. And sometimes, when they're in a malevolent mood, they strike back. Long ago, I realized that bad luck really does come in threes. Three accidents at once, three equipment failures one after another. That's just the universe righting itself, I thought. Now I think it's more personal than that, and it's deliberate. Otherwise, why is it that when I'm at my lowest, tired and stressed and sick and broke, that's when the hot water heater goes out? That's when my personal mojo is dark and weak and the garage door breaks. The plumbing backs up. The car won't start. I believe it's this unsung workforce of equipment and technology revolting just like any other unseen, unappreciated workforce. When workers are underpaid, overworked, unappreciated, what happens? They go on strike. They organize a revolution. They rise up against the king. Same with my stuff. If I take them for granted and don't show them I value them, what can I expect but rebellion? They collude. They whisper to one another, "She thinks she's so smart. Let's take her down a notch." Now that the hot water heater's replaced and the computer's working again, I'm turning over a new leaf. My new behavior is going to be full of gratitude and praise. "Good morning, garbage disposal. Aren't you looking well today?" "Hello, air conditioning system. How wonderful of you to come on so efficiently." "Greetings, all my stuff. Thank you for making my life easier. Now let's all get along one day at a time."
Connie Cronley is a freelance writer, the executive director of the Iron Gate Food Kitchen, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.